Hello and welcome to edition 412 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On this week's show, we'll be speaking to author and journalist Tim Moore. He wanted to experience life along the former Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe, and so he got on his bike and rode all 5,500 miles of it from Finland to Bulgaria.
Plus, we'll be hearing from Australian film director David Michaud about his new military satire for Netflix, War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, Ben Kingsley, Tilda Swinton, and more.
We'll also look at some of the best bits of Clerkenwell Design Week here in London, and we'll be delving into the neighbourhood's past with printmaker Alex Booker.
All that, plus the news look ahead with Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan, and we'll hear from Monocle's Chris Lord too. That's coming up in the next hour here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, one story has sadly dominated the news all of this week, the horrific bombing of a pop concert here in the UK in the city of Manchester. It killed over 20 people, many of them children. Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord, has been in the city reporting for us all week, and he joins us now.
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. I mean, as soon as we woke up in the morning, I was on basically the first train I could get out there. And I think what was, you know, having covered in the last couple of years, especially here on Monocle 24, the bombs that have happened in Istanbul, the events, the upset and the way that has unfolded there, and then to kind of go back to my hometown and sort of see a similar atrocity of what I used to see in Istanbul, which was very, I mean, for me as a journalist and someone reporting on it, it was just a very troubling and challenging day. But then at the same time, you know, as you mentioned, we all sort of rallied together. We covered it in the right way. And I hope, you know, our readers out there all over the world, I hope they got a sense of how that city responded to the tragedy and how it sort of came together and tried to sort of keep everybody on side, keep everybody's, you know, eyes on the future and sort of not descend into complete mournfulness in that sense.
I was just going to say, it's one thing covering an attack where the military or the police or what seems to be the institutions of the state, no matter how awful that is too, but here we had an attack that was taking on children, the parents waiting for their children to come out of the concert. We now know that many young guys from the gay community were also affected. And that must make it a very difficult story to start approaching people and asking them for their reactions, because it's so sensitive. Were you aware of that additional layer of tension on everything?
I think so, yeah, because the people that I spoke to, I remember one of the people I spoke to, I went down to Canal Street, which is the main street in Manchester's gay village district. And I spoke to a guy there called Tony Cooper, who's ran venues all up and down Canal Street for over 30 years. And, you know, one of the things he talked about was the fact that at that moment, which is the day after the attacks, one of their regulars hadn't, you know, it was still missing, hadn't been found after the bomb attack. He'd been there at the event that night. And he talked about, you know, how he remembered when the last big bomb that happened in Manchester in 1996, the IRA bomb, he remembered how that had cleared the city centre out. And he was very worried about what that's going to mean for, not necessarily for business, but for the life of the city, for the, you know, dynamic community that is there in Manchester. So that was very important. But what I did find as well, I mean, it was very sensitive and it was, you know, you have to handle these kind of things very carefully because people are still very raw. And as you mentioned, because it's children involved, even then, you know, even more personal for people, even more frightening for people. But what I did find as well is in a sort of a little bit of, you know, a Mancunian spirit in a way, is that lots of people said to me, especially who remembered that last time of the terror attack in 1996, they all said, it's not like this. We're going to push on. The city is not going to empty out. We're going to look to the future. We're going to keep getting out. And you'll see tonight, as one person said to me, you'll see tonight, everyone will be out in the streets, having a drink and trying to pull together and get through it. And that was the overriding feeling.
Indeed. Chris, thanks for coming to share your recollections of a very challenging week here on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Weekly, and we'll be hearing about some of next week's news next with Henry Rhys Sheridan. Stay tuned. Henry Rhys Sheridan, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Good
Thanks
to very have much, you Tom. Thank you very much.
Us. And we're looking ahead. We're looking ahead at events that may be unfolding. And Andrew, I guess this is the point, and we mark it in the show as well.
We acknowledge to our listeners, we are going to change the tone a little bit now, but But Henry, let's try and make people feel a bit happier this morning.
So we're going to begin by looking north, where Norway is going to be hosting the informal Nordic Prime Ministers meeting in Bergen. Is that how you say it? Anyway, it runs from the 29th of May until the 30th. And I have had the privilege, mainly in my capacity reporting for Monocle, of having been able to travel around several of the Nordic countries recently. And some stuff has really jumped out at me. First of all, how keenly felt a sense of kind of Nordic identity is up there. And that manifests itself both in terms of fellow feeling, but also a kind of keen sense of competition. And a lot of, people from the individual countries talk about, you know, what they're doing in relation to what people in the other countries have been up to. And part of the aim of this meeting is to ensure that the Nordic region remains the most integrated region in the world. Now, I'm not sure, you know, I'm sure many people out there would contest that definition, but people do talk about the region being harmonious, well-integrated, cooperative. I think it's worth pointing out that they don't have a monetary union, right? So I mainly learned this through my struggles with the bizarre Viking money with holes in it up there, an utter inability to kind of figure out what's worth what. But only Finland has the euro. Others have their various versions of the krona. And yeah, I don't know. I think it provides an interesting alternative model of what integration might look like, or what meaningful integration actually means.
I always find it fascinating that, you know, that until, you know, just over 100 years ago, Norway was in effect a colony of Sweden, and you have these two countries that pulled apart. Now it helps if you then, as the weaker partner, discover oil and realize you can buy your former colonial masters several times over. But the relationship between those Nordic people who were in such a difficult relationship is actually, that's all kind of parked in a really interesting way, and people kind of get on with, yeah, they have rivalries over who makes the nicest chair, or, you know, is my bun better than yours? But actually, it's not down to colonial issues anymore. That's the amazing thing, how those people have moved on. When you get an invitation to these things and it says, you know, to the informal Prime Minister's meeting, you always get worried that one of them is going to misunderstand and think that means kind of they can wear shorts and a tennis shoe.
In their gym jams, maybe.
Which... So which country's representative do you think would be most likely to do that? Judging, it's got to be the Finns, doesn't it?
I would imagine the Finns maybe, it's just generally attired in jammies and a dressing gown for various diplomatic engagements.
Is that mainly from your experience managing Marcus Hippie upstairs?
Well, you say managing, I mean, loosely.
Well, I think they'd want the whole thing to take place in the sauna, wouldn't they?
Ideally, I think. They might actually be petitioning for that.
So a flannel might be all he brings.
From the 28th of May till the 11th of June, Tom perhaps might be more excited about this than anyone else around this table. The French Open Tennis Championships is being held in Paris, Roland Garros. It's clay. What are the other surfaces among the... how many Grand Slam tournaments are there? Four, right?
Clay, hard court,
grass courts, Wimbledon, of course. Yeah. Okay. Oh, there are two hard courts.
Variants. So, you know, some of the balls move faster, depending if you're in Melbourne or at Flushing Meadows.
And what does it mean, open? What does that mean?
Well, so that changed to the open setup when the game sort of went professional, didn't it, back in the days?
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, I'm not...
It's about who's technically allowed to enter the fray.
So I could have a go.
I'm not sure. Are you ranked in the world's top 128 players, Andrew?
Not currently.
Just outside.
Yeah, just outside. But I actually watched... So when I was in Zurich for Monocle, I watched a wonderful film that I want to recommend to the listeners called The French. And it is by William Klein, famous photographer. It was released in 1982. And it's this remarkable behind-the-scenes documentary of Roland Garros in that year or the year before, I think.
Oh, 81, 82. So who have we got? You probably still got What's His Chops, Bjorn Borg.
Bjorg's around, knocking around, yeah. I think McEnroe's knocking around there.
Johnny
Young,
Mack
maybe. A couple of other famous people whose names I forgot. Mm. But just some of the footage.
Lendl, he was probably playing, wasn't he? Might have been one at one of those.
Ivan,
years.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The access, I think, in particular, that Klein had in comparison. Now, I think there was a remake of it a couple of years ago, which was just a kind of completely... It was just PR'd to death.
A pale imitation. You know,
yeah, you know, he's kind of in the massage rooms and the physiotherapist rooms. It's really worth watching.
William Klein was over here recently for Photo London.
Was he?
Yeah, giving a talk.
Excellent.
Fred Perry, was he there?
Maybe in some kind
I think that's slightly after his time. Perhaps
oh, okay.
In name and spirit, if not in person. And on the 29th of May, this is going to be interesting, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, is going to meet Emmanuel Macron at Versailles, nonetheless. And apparently this has some kind of symbolic element. It's going to be coinciding with an exhibition to mark Russian Tsar Peter the Great's visit to France 300 years ago. Now, obviously, geopolitically, this is interesting because it's got the kind of Putin who has been, I think, widely resented for being a little bit of an antagonist on the world stage in recent years, meeting the bright new hope of Europe's future. Let's hope he avoids some of the faux pas that Peter the Great made on his visit.
Can you give us a furnish us with some more detail?
So this is from Versailles' very own website. Apparently, he had a reputation for being indomitable and somewhat eccentric. He flouted court etiquette, Tom, on several occasions. For example, he installed his harem in the former apartment of the famously prudish Madame de Matillon. Now, you can't get away with that nowadays, can you?
You shouldn't be installing your harem anywhere. Least of all, not in a... In her actual quarters.
An elderly matron's quarters. He also insisted on meeting her despite her frail old age. I don't know.
How did that meeting?
That reminds me of a different world politician.
Harem scarum, I think.
At the moment.
That's good.
But yeah, I mean, listen, they're going to have a lot to talk about, aren't they?
Well, and it's interesting, Macron has not, because there's been a bit of a tradition in France of not, I don't know what the words, not sort of a sort of appeasing talk, but of being more open towards the idea that France needs to cultivate something of a special relationship with Moscow and needs to make particular allowances. And yet Macron has not engaged in that narrative at all. He's been pretty critical. So, yeah, that will certainly be, it could be incendiary, be interesting to watch.
Well, thank you very much, Henry, for coming to see us.
Thank you, guys.
Impressive stuff.
Yes, thanks, Henry. Do stay with us. We'll be speaking to the journalist, humorist and cyclist, Tim Moore, next.
Tim Moore has been referred to as Bill Bryson on two wheels, and with good reason. The travel-hungry author and journalist recently took to the road to tackle the route of the old Iron Curtain along the borders of Eastern Europe, all 5,500 miles of it, and he did it all on a tiny-wheeled, two-geared East German shopping bike.
Tim's trip stretched from snowy Finland and ended in sunny Bulgaria, reflecting on the legacy of the Soviet Union along the way. His journey is retold in his new book, The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, and it follows previous efforts, we should say, in which he's ridden around countries such as France and Italy on contraptions of varying quality and in circumstances of, I don't know how to describe it, Tim, different, challenging natures. He joins us now to tell us more about all of these adventures. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Tim, let's start with this one. There's obviously a map included in the book. It looks a very long way. It sounds a very long way. It sounds very uncomfortable. Was it?
Well, yes, it is a very long way, and it wasn't massively comfortable, but I think you referred to the previous two books, Adam. There seems to be a kind of, you know, trajectory that you have to, you know, you can't do something easier or less challenging. So even though I'm getting older and older, somehow I've got in this position where I keep having to do things that are sort of sillier and harder. So having gone around Italy on this 100-year-old wooden wheeled bike, I had to kind of up the ante in a way that seemed like a good idea at the time. I think I discovered about the East German bike was actually kind of almost came before the journey. So I sort of discovered about these, it's called the MIFA 900. It's this 20-inch wheel shopping bike, which they made 3 million of in the old East Germany. Just the 3 million of them, which I think if you take China out of the equation, makes it the most, well, say popular, that's the wrong word, the most widely produced bicycle in the history of bicycles. And I thought, that sounds great, what a great story. And then I heard out about this Iron Curtain bike trail, which apparently nobody had ever done. I got in touch with the European Cycling Federation, and I said, it looks like quite a long way. I said, oh, actually, yeah, if you do it, can you tell us? Because we don't know, because no one's done it. So that was wow, quite exciting for me, to be a trailblazer in that way. So, yeah, I went off in the... I mean, it would have been a lot more sensible, I have to say, to have started at the other end, at the sunny end, and ended up in the, you know, the top of the Arctic Circle at a sunny time of year.
I would have stopped after day one. It's horrendous. You're frozen. That you've included pictures as well of your bicycle. You're just covered in ice. And on that first day, was there any? Do you never get that beginning of it, just thinking, oh God, this is almost too much. I might just put this back of a taxi, and no one will know.
Yeah, well, actually, I think in the first few weeks, I was in such a sort of rolling state of disbelief and shock at what I'd actually let myself in for. That kind of, in some weird way, kept me going. I didn't actually sort of have time, really, to sit down and appreciate the full horror of my folly. And yeah, it was ridiculous. It was a massive snowstorm, a really, really super massive snowstorm. My flight up to the Arctic Circle was diverted like 6 hours away, and I had to get this coach through the night. And I kind of unpacked this tiny, tiny little bike on the steps of this funny hotel up in Kirkenes, which is like the most northerly hotel in the world, I think, actually, pretty much apart from Spitsbergen.
And they think you're idiots as well.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, the good thing about people up in that part of the world, they obviously, even if you have just lived there generally, going about your normal daily business, you are quite hard and therefore kind of have quite a sort of, you know, just a tolerant understanding of people doing stupid things. Living there is a bit odd to begin with. So people would just, you know, can't, you know, point out in a pretty frank way, yeah, that's a really stupid thing to be doing. you know, a bicycle this time of year, that bicycle, well, you know, anyway, there we are. You made your own bed, mate, go and lie in it. Yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I've never really done anything on this scale at all. It was way, way further than anything I've cycled before. And the whole cold thing. And someone said, well, get one of these little sort of camelback water pouchy things, which I, again, never used, but fill it up with really hot water, you know, so it won't melt. And also, so actually it will preserve your kind of body temperature core and you won't die. So I did that, probably just as well, being in Finland, one of the few countries where you'd actually happily drink out of the hot tap. So I filled that boiling hot water. And within about half an hour, I got this really big hill outside Kirkenes. And I thought, well, I'm getting a bit thirsty now, and the whole mouthpiece completely frozen solid. And then actually, I think later on that day, like the I had this anorak thing and all the sort of, because I've got to say, I wasn't actually, apart from my extremities, I had so many. I mean, I was wearing kind of, you know, ski salopettes and everything. I wasn't actually cold. Nonetheless, you kind of you all the sweat that you're producing as you're kind of pulling this stupid little bike up this hill kind of leaches outwards, and the entire sort of outside of my anorak just froze solid. I literally could have just taken it off and stood it up in the snow next to me.
Now, Tim, it's interesting. You talked about some, what should we call them, constructive doubters, certainly at the start of the journey. But like a lot of great, you know, travelogues or great madcap adventures, this journey again is punctuated by people along the way helping out, pitching in with comments, constructive and negative. Did that all kind of broadly go the way you were expecting, you know, from country to country? Was the reception very different? Don't give away all of the sort of plot developments, if you like, but how much did people surprise you along the way?
Well, I've got to say, over the years, I have learned, it's slightly disappointing, that generally speaking, nations do tend to live up to their least flattering national stereotypes. And so, yeah, in Finland, they were, you know, very dour. But at the same time, their catchphrase was, I remember, weirdly, this is actually, I can't get over this, I only had one puncture on this entire journey. Even weirder, that was on this sort of huge snowbank in Finland. Like, how? What's going on? And so I was changing the puncture, and it was really, obviously really cold. And I had these studded tyres. I managed to find these studded snow tyres for a shopping bike. Who in the hell would manufacture these things anyway? So obviously it was a bit painful getting in the, you know, bare hands, studded tyre, and a car, actually. Because, I mean, at this stage, I was seeing about one car every 3 hours, and this guy kind of like rumbled all, and this big Finnish guy with a huge gingery beard just said, oh, a bicycle, that's a bad idea. That's a very bad idea. But if you need help, you will ask. And then he just drove away. But nonetheless, that was their catchphrase. And, you know, the bike did kind of fall apart in a way in the first bits of Finland, because largely thanks to me, because I tried to sort of alter it a bit to prepare it for this journey it was never intended to do. And all the bits that I tried to, all my custom add-ons, just all fell off and broke. And I would go and knock on a sort of hibernating farmhouse door, and then after about 10 minutes, some old man would come out in his big woolly socks and not speaking a word of English, and I would just point in a feeble way at my stricken bike, and he'd go off to his tractor shed and come out with a, you know, massive toolkit with like sockets the size of my head and just go to work on it and see me on my way. And that happened a lot. By the same token, you know, I mean, all the Finns, obviously the Finns and Russia have got a bit of history going on there, so they were quite keen to point out that I might not have a great time in Russia. And they said, oh, well, you will need help, and they will not give it to you. And, yeah, sure enough, they did. And they were, it was, yeah, just pretty relentlessly hostile, really, large parts of Russia. I mean, there were obviously, you know, as in everything, there were a couple of, you know, fun people who were quite nice, but generally speaking, people didn't think what I was doing was a bit silly and eccentric. It was just annoying and fury making, and they just, you know, would stare you out as you went past and things. But yes, you know, funny things, actually, like East Germany. Obviously, East Germany, West Germany doesn't really exist as two countries, but you could always tell when you crossed over the border because, you know, just the buildings would change a bit. Sometimes the East German roads still have loads of cobbles on them and stuff like that. But the other thing was that people were friendlier, which I've got to say, that was not what I was expecting. I thought they would be a bit kind of buttoned up and, you know, kind of strangers would be something still to be slightly suspicious of, because in historical terms, it wasn't that long ago the wall came down. I mean, certainly if you're really old like me, it seems like not that long ago at all. So anyone over the age of like 40 would have been brought up in the Soviet years. But yet, nonetheless, they were all, you know, if I could tell when I crossed the border, because you'd get people waving at me. And I guess I thought afterwards, why is this? And it's probably still because, you know, people of that generation, they're not used to seeing strangers, and it's still something exciting and novel.
Because you say when you cross over into what was West Germany, it was like you were entering model towns. It was like everything was so kind of picture perfect. But when you went along the border, the old border, the old Iron Curtain, this division between what was, you know, the communist Soviet bloc and a capitalist West, How hard does that border still feel in place? You there in Germany, you've given an example that's good about the characteristics of the people. But as you came all the way down, did you still sense it was there in some form?
East and West Germany was the only country that was actually divided, and that's what makes it more obvious, and that's where the scars still haven't really healed, and they still like to you know, remind you as a sort of warning from history. This is where the border once stood, and they have lots of sections of it preserved and things. Elsewhere, I mean, fundamentally, it's, yeah, I mean, you're going from what was Western Europe to what was Eastern Europe, or, you know, the crossing into the ex-Soviet land. So, yes, they are, by a large part, they're just much poorer countries. So if you're going from Austria into Hungary, you can tell straight away that people aren't, you know, that are less wealthy and so on. In terms of the mentality, people were, you know, consistently fairly approachable. I mean, Serbia was a country that I didn't really know much about and has a bit of a dodgy rep, and I wasn't really sure what to expect there. And maybe because I was kind of building up to being this sort of, you know, pariah state, and I'd be kind of in hot water there. But actually, that was the one surprise, that people there were much more approachable and friendlier. And I guess maybe that's partly because Yugoslavia, as was never really part of the Soviet bloc, and they therefore feel themselves a bit friendlier than you know, the former communist countries might have done. But that was a great surprise.
And Tim, what about, we talked about the sort of the warmth of the welcome. Was there anywhere that you arrived and people, I don't know, was there any place where they sort of got the project better than elsewhere, or was it a fairly uniform reaction, like, well, that's just a terrible idea?
Well, I did, it was very few and far between. Sometimes I remember there was the first time I was actually cycling, just I think I was just about to go into Germany from Poland on the sort of Baltic coast there, and I stopped at this you know, traffic lights, and this fairly scary looking young skinhead type sat up next to me on his beaten up bike. And I thought, okay, here we go. He's gonna like, and he just like looked at the bike, looked up at me, and just gave me a big thumbs up, in a kind of, in a way that sort of, yeah, that is a bit of a stupid thing to be doing, but fair play for doing it. Other than that, I've got to say that, you know, people would say, I'll turn up at their guest house, or, I mean, in Finland, sometimes at their reindeer farm or their recently decommissioned bank, that sort of thing, because obviously you can't really pick and choose up there. And people would say, oh, well that's a bicycle, wow. But then when they saw the actual bicycle, somehow it's such the opposite of an expeditionary machine. It just somehow seemed to deflate everyone's excitement. Like, oh, I think that was what drew me to it. It's an anti-hero, and I didn't want some big, huge, competent, you know, multi-terrain vehicle. By the same token, that meant that people didn't kind of take me seriously, and just somehow the whole thing seemed so silly to them that they couldn't really engage with it. Partly because the distance was so ludicrous. I had this laminated map of the route, which I thought, well, that'll be a nice evening activity, and I'll colour in my progress. And after 2 weeks, I'd put this marker pen along, and I'd just like barely done literally a dot on this map. And I just thought, I just had to cycle every single day, wake up and just ride for hours and hours and hours, which meant in a way that I didn't really have time to interact with people. And I'd just go flying through places like, you know, Slovakia, just in a, like about 2.5 hours, and then I'd realised, like, oh, that was Slovakia. I didn't even slow down, really, let alone kind of have a good chat about what the
9,000 kilometres. I mean, do you have it to this?
It was, I think, it was 8,858. Well, maybe actually it was 8,558. That's what it was. Yeah.
Now, wow. Most writers, you know, the kind of worst that can happen to them is they get a bit of RSI. You've done Journeys by Donkeys, and this isn't your first epic journey by bicycle. Physically, do you have like huge calves?
I must say, actually, yeah, that's Thank you for that. Let's all sit down and share this beautiful image. My calves are actually, they are the one legacy. I do have really quite impressive. It looks like someone strapped a really massive turkey breast to the back of each of my legs. They're not bad at all. Other than that, I've got no idea how I get away with it, because I don't really... I lead this strange sort of binary existence, and sitting at home in London, staring gormlessly at a monitor for, 18 and a half months, and then going away and just doing far too much stuff in this intensive period.
Well, I was going to ask, did you do any kind of...
No, I literally did nothing. One of my neighbours came round to help me kind of, put the bike together. And he said, so why don't you go and give it a go and see how it feels? And I went around the block and came back again. He said, well, is it any better? I said, yeah, it's a lot better. That was the first time I'd ridden it. I didn't have the heart to sell him that. But I literally rode it around the block once, and that was it.
Ready for 8,500 kilometres?
I think not being morbidly obese is the only advantage I have in this respect. So, and actually the fact that it was very flat. Europe, I didn't realise quite how flat large swathes of Europe are. So the first hill, apart from this first hill right outside my starting point, I didn't have to engage the second of my two gears for about 4,000 kilometres. Just no hills. So by the time the hills came along, just by default, I was in the shape of my life, just like sitting on an exercise bike for day after day after day in a meat fridge.
You've made a career out of travel writing, of telling these extraordinary stories. And, we made that comparison to Bill Bryson. He's one of the other few people who's managed to be in that world. How difficult was it to get that going in the beginning? Because the success, of course, is having a book that then other people go and explore all your other books, making a little world. How difficult was it to get going and be somebody telling funny stories when there was always this blooming guy, Bill Bryson, around the corner? And let's be honest, he's written a nice quote for your book as well.
Has he?
I think I've read a quote at him, but well, he likes it.
He did like it, but then we tried to pin him down. And it's like, please, please. I mean, as consumed with jealousy as I am about the achievements of Mr. Bill Bryson, at the same time, I do kind of owe him a career, really. So when he got in touch, I said, oh yeah, I really like that. I thought, can we run with that? Can we stick on the back cover? I thought, no, they won't anyway. So he's been too busy to actually confirm.
Okay. I was told he had given it the thumbs up.
He did give it the thumbs up, but only in a way that I think he obviously has to guard himself very carefully. But no, I mean, I make no bones about it. It was a classic right place at the right time. The first ever piece of travel writing I did, I went off actually a lot of the last parts of the route that I did on this last book in this 1990 with my wife, and we drove around Eastern Europe in this clapped out old Saab, and I came back and just wrote a sort of, what I did on my strange holiday thing in the Independent, it was. And 3 days later, so a bloke from HarperCollins got in touch and said, I really enjoyed that piece. Have you heard of Bill Bryson? Because I think you could probably do something in that vein. So I do kind of owe it to him. And it was, I think, because he was so phenomenally successful, and because he's also irksomely more versatile and cleverer than me, he's sort of broadened his output a bit into this nice portfolio career of doing his, histories of domestic appliances and stuff in a way that only he can make interesting. And I can't do that, so I'm still...
I don't think you can tackle the Iron Curtain on a shopping bike, though, to be fair.
Well, in a way, that's a part of me that feels I have to make up for the fact that I'm not quite as good as Bill Bryson. I have to just punish myself in some sort of physical penance
nothing wrong with one-upmanship as a motivating factor for great writing.
We already know there's a legs workout book in there as well.
Yeah, show me Bill Bryson's calves. You're going to be sorely disappointed.
It's only right to wrap up on that note. Tim Moore, thank you very much for being with us. The brilliant book is The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold: Adventures Along the Iron Curtain, and it's available in all good bookshops now.
Thanks very much.
Time for some music now, Andrew. I thought it might be rather nice to play something from, a bit of an icon of the Manchester music scene, given how we kicked off the programme. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a very wise thing today.
Good stuff. Well, let's hear from New Order. This is Ceremony.
Well, that was New Order from back in 1981 with Ceremony there. We'll be hearing from film director David Michaud after this.
Australian filmmaker David Michaud has been celebrated for recent work that includes the dystopian drama The Rover and crime flick Animal Kingdom, both featuring stellar casts, including his frequent collaborator Guy Pearce.
Michaud's latest film is for Netflix and it's called War Machine, a darkly comic satire looking at the conflict in Afghanistan and starring Brad Pitt.
It's based on journalist Michael Hastings' book The Operators, which itself grew from Hastings' 2010 Rolling Stone article The Runaway General. That article eventually cost its subject, NATO commander in Afghanistan General Stanley McChrystal, his job, and Hastings himself sadly died in a car accident in 2013. Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with David Michaud a little earlier to discuss the film.
I had been thinking for quite a long time about wanting to make a film set in one of these kind of theatres of modern American war. I had been reading a lot, researching a lot, trying to find a way in, hadn't found the right one. And there was something dark and brutal about the reading I'd been doing that was making my way in feel difficult. And that might kind of, anyone who's familiar with the films I'd made before might have thought that it was that dark brutality that would have made that stuff appealing to me, but I don't know, maybe it was, it just made the films feel difficult. And in this one, at a certain point, Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner from Plan B brought me this book by Michael Hastings called The Operators, which is about a Rolling Stone journalist following a four-star American general on around Afghanistan and around Europe. And I saw my way in immediately, and that way in was like sharp satire, was absurdity.
SWAR's been running 8 years now. Given your reputation and your formidable drive, our hope is that you're the man who will get the job done.
Most of us here will know General McMahon's the man who kicked Al-Qaeda in the sack.
You're welcome.
Get your troops in order. Move the needle a little bit. Show everyone a nice looking set of graphs.
Just finish this thing.
It's a lost cause.
We can stay in Afghanistan forever.
That's why I'm gonna win it. My team and I are about to embark on a new direction.
What is this new direction?
We build Afghanistan into a free and prosperous nation.
All right, smile for the camera's clip.
Sounds a lot like the old direction.
You know, and I suddenly found what I found appealing was the idea of making a war film that was following in a kind of lineage of American war satire. And I also, it made me aware of the fact that that kind of film seems to have disappeared. You know, America especially doesn't make films anymore about the experience of war as told through the lens of comedy.
Talking about satire and war films, I mean, one thing that I found interesting watching it, as you were talking about, I mean, some of the subject matter, or at least the root of it, is this, obviously, the brutal theatre of war. And there are obviously absurd and humorous moments within, even, I guess, the real situation, but certainly within your film. But what satire are you really directly sort of trying to resurrect? Which films informed this? I mean, I know the obvious one maybe might be Dr. Strangelove, something like that. But at what point does a film cross over into satire? Are there any classic war movies which you treat as maybe slightly absurd in their way?
You know, other than obviously Strangelove, there's Catch-22 and there's MASH. And I mean, even something as ridiculous as Stripes, you know, it feels in a way like the kind of movie that doesn't get made anymore. And it's something to do with the changing nature of America's relationship to its military and to its militarism. I have no idea, honestly, how this film is going to be received. And I don't know how it's going to be received in America. You know, I'm at the beginning of a process here of talking about it and blah, blah, blah. But it feels important to me that it be made. You know, it feels important to me that we be capable of holding these institutions up to critical and satirical analysis, because we can't allow this stuff to treat itself so seriously as to be somehow beyond criticism and beyond ridicule.
Yeah, I mean, satire and humour, they are, in their most basic form, scrutiny. They're holding up a mirror, aren't they? you've said that you're maybe slightly wary of how the film might be received in the US, but it obviously has this stellar US cast and obviously Brad Pitt. I mean, let's say what it is, the biggest film star in the world. How did that come about?
His company brought me the book, and his enthusiasm for the project made itself clear to me pretty quickly. You know, it was, I had a meeting with him before I started writing it, and you know, he was, I mean, Michael Hastings' book doesn't read as it's not satire, it's a book about a journalist and his experiences following a general around. But he and I, Brad and I, came to the same conclusion independently, which was that our way in was the high absurdity of that delusion, which seems endemic at the upper layers of the military and the civilian executive.
Yeah, as you were discussing, I mean, the source material, Michael Hastings' book, The Operators, based on this Rolling Stone assignment where he spent a period with this military outfit. And one of the lines in the film is something along the lines of, and I'll misquote it, but the essence is, what the hell were they letting him along for the ride anyway for? Like, why did they allow him that access? Have you had any feedback from any members of the military community about their views on a film being made of this? Because obviously, Michael Hastings, who tragically died, he had feelings that he was being slightly pursued, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know that any of those feelings he had that he voiced before he died about feeling like he was, whatever it was at the time, being followed or watched, or I don't think any of that had to do with his, certainly didn't have, I don't think had anything to do with this particular story. He was a hardworking journalist who wanted to not leave stones unturned. I wouldn't necessarily even say that I'm wary of how it will be received. I just don't know. You know, there's something exciting about that. You know, obviously there was a lot of military guys around when we were making the film, providing us with all sorts of assistance. And I could tell that some of them were wary of us, you know, initially. They could see that what we were doing was in the world of satire and in the world of parody, and were, you know, for maybe momentarily suspicious of our intentions. But it was gratifying for me to get to the end of the process of shooting and to have a bunch of those guys come up to me and say, and admit that those were their initial feelings, but then say that this film felt to them like a film that needed to be made.
Obviously, this is a complex topic and a complex story, but I mean, the media love to take one line away and stick it on there so people can understand. When I was watching it and I was trying to sort of distill it down, it's a quite free-ranging, rambling, quite real-feeling experience, I guess. But I guess the one thing I really took away from it was almost this sense of war is kind of a business. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's alluded to maybe in the title, War Machine, but it's, to the people who are engaged in it, it's business as usual every day, and there's monotony in it, and there's a sense of begrudging duty of getting the job done, and you know, fallouts between the people doing the jobs, bickering and stuff like that. I mean, were you trying to make a point there about how these atrocious acts to a large number of people doing them are kind of business as usual?
Yeah, I mean, or at least, you know, to a certain extent, for me, the movie is about vanity and ambition, you know, and so you do get, in some ways, you know, a certain amount of the satire in it is built on the back of the banality of career management, you know. And for me, that was part of my principal way in, was to understand that these people have ambition and life aspirations that aren't necessarily dissimilar to those that any of us have. The principal difference between these people and the rest of us is that the consequences of the decisions they make in this career management can be like catastrophic.
And just tell me a little bit about how the film was made, like methodically. I mean, did you get to visit Afghanistan? Did you research in that way, or did you just more speak to the people that have been there? How did you kind of research and go about piecing this film together?
No, I didn't go to Afghanistan. The opportunity to do so didn't. It doesn't easily present itself to someone like me. But I did a huge amount of research. You know, I'd been reading and watching and talking to people for years before I started writing it. But then, as I said, you know, it's like, in a way, when it came time to actually, you know, when we went into pre-production, when we started location scouting, you know, it's difficult. Look, Afghanistan is a very particular place. Difficult to find a place that looks exactly like it, because there are so many different kinds of Afghanistan. You know, Kabul looks totally different to Kandahar. You know, it was important to me that I surround myself with people who were there to just constantly reassure me that we were getting things right. You know, at the same time, the movie is like, I mean, it's, the movie is mental, you know, it's half kind of goofball satire and half battlefield trauma. And when the movie exists in a world as nuts as that, you know, it gives you a certain amount of wiggle room, creative wiggle room.
I also wanted to talk about the soundtrack made by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. Do they work alongside, or do you give them the finished film and they start to work to it? I mean, I'm interested distinctly in them because obviously they are personalities outside the film, you know, and they're hugely respected artists. How does your relationship work with them when adding music to the film?
You know, so they came on board early. I think they came on board before we had started shooting. Oh man, it's taken a long time to finish this movie. It's a long time to make it, so my timeline's gone fuzzy. But they came on at a script stage, and then, you know, in a way, it wasn't until I cut for the first 4 months in Sydney, and then brought the film to London, and then kept cutting here. And very soon after I got here, I went to Brighton and I started working with Nick and Warren. And it was a kind of beautiful, you know, it's like a process of them building music out of, not just out of their experience of the cut of the film we had at that stage, but also out of me sitting in a room with them talking about the flavor of it, you know. And the flavor of this movie is really unusual. So, I mean, I feel lucky that I got to go down to Brighton like 4 or 5 times for like a week at a time and just spend that time sitting in a little room with master craftsmen watching music just appear out of nowhere almost, you know.
Well, that was Tom Hall speaking to the Australian film director David Michaud there. And War Machine is available on Netflix right now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. This week, a small pocket of London has been welcoming the best in global design to the city. The neighbourhood is Clerkenwell, and the reason they were all here, well, it's Clerkenwell Design Week.
So to end the show today, we're joined by a homegrown design talent, printmaker Alex Booker, founder of Booker Print House here in London, as part of Clerkenwell Design Week's Design Undefined project. Alex has been creating a series of prints based on historic characters local to Clerkenwell.
These range from Eleanor Marx, daughter of a certain Karl, a founder member of the Socialist League and campaigner for women's rights, to the more recent legacy left in London by the architect Zaha Hadid. And Alex joins us now to tell us about some of Clerkenwell's characters, including himself, maybe. let's start with Clerkenwell. So it's a central London district of London, just to the east, and has been associated with Italians and watchmaking and all sorts of things. But tell us what your version of Clerkenwell is, because it's long been connected with printmaking as well.
It has. There was lots of print studios for the newspaper trade. I set out to sort of maybe look into the sort of watchmaking, the jewellery trade legacy, but I basically picked up a book by David Rosenberg called Rebel Footprints, and it takes you on a walking tour around Clerkenwell and around various parts of London. And from there, I was just like introduced to various characters who've lived there. And from there, I just thought, well, why not just get involved with these people? Because it's had a strong history, as you mentioned, through Italian immigration, through political demonstration rallying point. So, for instance, Clerkenwell Green was the third biggest demonstration in part of London after Hyde Park and Trafalgar Square.
And the Karl Marx Library was there for a long
time. Yeah, and then the Karl Marx. And you've also got the Crown Pub, which it's gone down in history as apparently where Lenin and Trotsky plotted the Russian Revolution. And you had, for instance, someone called William Lovett, who was a Cornishman who moved to London, who actually, he was actually, I would say, the first character I came to, because his role was, as a leader of the Chartist movement, was, I suppose, his main goal was to help educate the working classes, and through that form unions at the time. So that for me was just like a really exciting kind of introduction. And from there, I managed to read about people like Giuseppe Manzini, who was an Italian patriot who was exiled firstly to Switzerland, but then ended up in Clerkenwell in London.
So a really kind of rebellious and outspoken part of London. Tom, you're looking at the cards. Any take your shine?
Well, no, I always find it amazing how characterful, I guess, woodcut printing is. I mean, and obviously I'm sure you're going to be an advocate of that, given it's your medium. But there seems to be something you can really capture, I don't know, I guess you would say better than almost any medium, you can really capture the quality of people's faces.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's about defining their faces with the kind of lines you'd see on their faces if they were really there.
I think it lends itself to, you can create really dramatic images through the way that you cut using various tools, be that like traditional sets of tools where you have a V blade and a U blade and various types of knives. But even like modern routers, for instance. But it's also the way, it's the way that the wood splinters and cuts. And it's also the way the ink sits on the blocks. For me, that had been a long fascination. There's a great scope for experimentation through that medium, I find.
And you've got some of the blocks. I mean, I'm trying to describe this for our listeners here. This is presumably what one of the wooden cut blocks.
Yeah, so that,
You're very good at this, Tom.
It's tricky, Andrew.
So you almost look like you're looking at a shadow at the moment because basically you've got, you've essentially got a silhouette in some ways because the space that you want printed is the face and then the rest of the area has just been cut away, like I was saying, like using various tools. And what you're left with is just the end figure. But he was actually also part of two blocks. So I printed a background with a different block, but you use a line called a Kento line, which is the registration line. So basically every time you drop the paper, it sits on exactly the same line, which is cut on both blocks. And he was a fascinating character. He was the first Asian MP in England from 1892 to 1895. And just an amazing human for way ahead of his time. He was basically a feminist. He was did a lot of work for women's rights. He even travelled to children's homes, girls' homes in India to teach them because at a time when it wasn't accepted for girls actually to go to school, he had a big effect on Gandhi.
Well, and Gandhi himself called him the father of India.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Revered company.
And it's strange because I've seen his name on street signs around there. And I've often wondered, because it's such an unusual name to see on an old street sign, who he was. And here he was, you know, he was in politics, you know, so he was alive from 1825 to 1917. So that's an incredibly early time to be in Parliament as an Asian member of...
I mean, he was also a real polymath. I mean, he was an economist, an ethical businessman. He was trading in cotton and opium in Liverpool before the time when they really knew the effect opium was going to have on addiction.
I was going to say, that's a loose interpretation of ethical business.
Well, I was going to say, but
in those days, it was
fine. But then evidence was coming out, and then there was leading to like the opium wars. And basically, he opted out within 3 years. He was like, no, this is, I can't do this. But he was a mathematician as well. And he was even had an effect on Jinnah, who was the first prime minister of Pakistan.
And tell me, we see how things are changing in the world, media and print and the rush to digital. Now, here's you with your wood blocks and your scalpels and your U knives. Why have you found that a more rewarding part of print to stay in?
I think it began because it was very simple to get your hands on a piece of, for instance, birch ply, which you can find in any timber yard across the UK or the world. And it's just quite an intimate way of working where you can draw up a block freehands, and then you can just immediately cut into this object and then you can print it up within minutes and then you have an image and then you can make decisions. You can either use different colour or you can cut more and more away. I just find it really accessible and really exciting. And
but time consuming in comparison to digital. So how do you make a career for yourself out of this? Are you working with other people who are artists? Are you making book covers? Who's your clientele?
I work with on commissions. I work running workshops now, which I actually run through Airbnb now on their experience app. So that's been like a new kind of way of, I suppose, a new income to help the studio. I'll probably say something that a lot of artists don't want people to know, but I actually juggle art technician work in galleries. So, and London's a wonderful place for that. I work in some brilliant museums like the Royal Academy of Arts and galleries like Listen, Pace Gallery. And through that helps me not only have some kind of understanding of the art world, and the market, but also it actually just allows me to give maybe a week or two off in the studio to really plow on with projects. But I mean, like I was saying, like even today coming from workshops, for me, it's been really exciting to begin teaching on quite a regular basis and to see the delight that people get from, like I was saying, the simplicity of cutting shapes. It could be anything, patterns, shapes, figures, landscapes, and then to see the results so immediately. And using various types of paper, I often use a Hosho paper, which is a beautiful handmade Japanese paper.
So can you be spotted in the galleries because you have very inky hands?
Yeah.
Is there a lot of scrubbing of your hands
and
at the end
of the
day?
And a lot of splinters, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I've had to upgrade my... I'm allowed to say things like Ecova. Get some things that are a bit kinder and better for my hand and the environment.
You can take endorsements on that. That's actively encouraged. That strikes me really interesting, what you say about that idea of being a bit more, I don't know, you're saying being aware of like some of the commercial imperatives, the commercial realities of gallery work. We often talk to people behind magazines on the radio, and often the editors say, well, you kind of need to be, you need to be a publisher and you need to sort of be a business person as well if you want to make a success. Do you think there's still a reluctance from some artists, I guess you'd call it, to engage with that fact, to some of these commercial realities? Because I guess some of them say, look, that's too stark a choice. I'm quite binary. I'm creative. I don't do any of that. Is that a bit naive, maybe, in some quarters?
I think it's slightly insulting, I think, because I think it gives the impression that people are like, just sort of wandering around daydreaming in their studio and not kind of doing what lots of other people have to do, which is certain jobs that we don't enjoy doing for most of our days or hours. And I think it also gives you a good perspective. It helps you with time management. It says, right, okay, so I'm going to do a week on this install and then I've got 2 weeks off. And for me, it's helped. And also, it's helped me survive as an artist. And one of the great things I love about London is that there's not only great communities like the art world, design world, but there are these institutions where you can work in an area that's so related to your own practice.
So people can come to bookaprinthouse.com and see your work there and buy it there.
Yeah.
And these pieces, where would they find the characters of Clerkenwell? How can they get hold of these?
They would find them at 155 to 157 Clerkenwell London shop on Farringdon Road. The pieces exhibited will be hung for another couple of weeks. I've had a great time just learning more about, you know, my city and specifically Clerkenwell, and about these wonderful people who I think sometimes maybe get a bit lost.
Alex, thanks for coming to see us. You can find more of Alex's work, as Andrew mentioned, at bookaprinthouse.com. And why not hit the pedals or hit the streets and go and see Clerkenwell for yourself. Alex, thanks for coming to chat with us.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks a lot.
Well, there we go, Andrew. Another edition of the Monocle Weekly has been and gone. I don't know, I'm rather inspired to maybe take a bit of a turn around Clerkenwell this afternoon, if the weather holds. Take a bit of a stroll around, see some of the sights, see if I can imagine some of those amazing old faces from the neighbourhood around back in the day.
A nice story, and it's not far from where I live, so I love that part of London because it's always been such a kind of an area that's changed so much even over the time I've been there. But what was great was, you know, we were talking about some of the old Italian characters. You still see that glimpse of a community that was there mainly in the kind of 20, 30 years ago. Most of it has moved on, but there's still an Italian church and there's still proper Italian tellers where people go on a Sunday. It's cool.
Perfect. I might get some Italian food. You know what I'm like whilst I'm walking around.
Come, let's go.
Road pasta for us. That's all for this edition 412 of the Monocle Weekly. Thanks to our producer, Tom Hall, and our studio manager, Claire Urban, and the others who helped out behind the glass.
And that's it. From me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.